Can you imagine what it feels like to be a Canadian soccer player as Peter Pendergast blows the whistle? It's official. Canada 2000 Gold Cup champions. How does that sound?
You're listening to the Northern Football Podcast with Peter Galindo and Thomas Neff.
Yes, it's episode 18 of the Northern Football Podcast. I'm Peter Galindo with Thomas Neff, and I don't know about you, Thomas, but I'm excited for the show we have lined up here.
Yeah, we sure do, Peter. David Wooten coming up very soon. We also could have the next Canadian to sign in the European transfer window. The Canadian women's national team Olympic squad also dropped, and CBL's back. We finally have games to talk about, and the MLS clubs had some mixed results as well.
To say the least, yes. And a reminder that the Northern Football Podcast is partnered with FTF Canada. If you are a soccer player aged 15 to 18 years old or know someone who is and have NCAA or U Sports aspirations, well then FTF Canada is the place to get you connected with the scouts who will help you achieve those goals. Use the promo code NFP2021 for 10% off FTF Canada's Boys and Girls Soccer Combines. For more info and schedules, go to ftfcanada.ca and follow them on Twitter at @FTFCanada_ and on Instagram at @FTFCanada_. Also, please hit subscribe and give us a rating and review. That helps the show immensely. Lots to discuss in Canadian soccer as usual, but it was a slower news week with the men's national team as we await the Gold Cup squad announcement and all the ramifications from that. So to make up for it, we're thrilled to welcome St. Johnstone and Canada midfielder David Wotherspoon onto the show. David, thanks so much for doing this. How are things?
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be asked onto your show. And yeah, things are great. It's been a busy and hectic year for myself. So I've had some downtime with my family recently. So, but looking forward to getting back into things for the season coming for us.
Well, for sure. Now, having had some time to reflect on it, how does it feel knowing that you are a part of a Canada squad that made history this month?
Yeah, it's unbelievable. I mean, to do something that the country's never done in the past 24 years is something to be very proud of, and to be part of that squad and the staff and everyone involved in it is very special. And it's been very enjoyable as well, just to be part of it and play minutes for the country as well. It's been extra special and honoured, privileged to be able to do it, and very proud of what we've achieved so far.
Well, you guys took that photo together in Chicago, the big squad photo. There were a lot of celebration videos as well, and we saw how excited everybody was. Were there any other celebrations that night that we didn't see, or was it just straight to the flight and move on?
It kind of was. It was one of those things that you can celebrate it afterwards, but you know the next day everyone's going back to their homes or their families and their countries and wherever they may be. It was celebrated afterwards very well by everyone. I think everyone enjoyed themselves, and but everyone was ready to see their families and get back and celebrate with them as well, because it's a great achievement. And it was great to just sit down and speak to a couple of the staff members that have been part of it for years, and they've went through all the bad times and all the good times in previous years trying to qualify for this stage, and to hear them talk about it and how much of an achievement it is this year, it really hit me, hit home, that it's a massive thing for the country and everyone involved in it. So it's great to be a part of, and great to hear some people's views on it. And looking forward to the next stages.
For sure. Now we have some listener questions, and thank you to the listeners for sending them in. The first one we got was from Ron from Toronto, who wants to know if you can describe the experience playing in Haiti, and if at any point did you feel unsafe?
we obviously talked about it going into the game. We were based in Chicago, and we knew we were going to go down there and play a game there, and the staff made us feel very safe in what we were doing. I didn't obviously know what to expect. Some people have experienced that sort of environment before, and they said it was going to be blistering hot heat and it's going to be intense and sort of intimidating as well. And it was. When we got there, it was basically off the flight and straight to the hotel, and then it was ready for the next day. And we had all the safety in place and just able to go out and play the game, which was great. But the heat was incredible. It was like 35 degrees or something, and the humidity was very intense. And they played it during the day as well, which was at its hottest point. But it was definitely an experience that I'll always remember. And getting on that bus and seeing the streets of Hawaii and the people walking around the streets, and it was something that I'll always remember.
John Herman also did mention that it would be a good experience for you guys in that way. So it's good to see that you guys also do appreciate it as well. Now, looking back, David, you were eligible to play for Canada through your mother, of course. And you mentioned when you committed that Scott Arfield's decision to play for Canada kind of swayed you to ultimately dive in with the program. Did any other factors influence your decision to play for Canada as well?
No, I think that was sort of the main one, where I saw the likes of Scott Arfield making the decision, and I just knew in the back of my head that I was able to do that if they ever wanted me to. And as soon as John got me on the phone and wanted to do it, I didn't have any sort of hesitations on whether to do it or not. It's an opportunity of a lifetime, and it's certainly a country that's the heart of my family, with my grandparents lived there for 12 years, and it's certainly they grew up, well, my mum grew up there for 5 years, and it's certainly something that I would have been proud of if I was ever to pull on the shirt. And I'm very thankful and proud to be able to say I've done that, and hope to do it some more.
Now, speaking of Scott, have you chatted with him recently? Because I know there's a lot of confusion whether he's going to kind of come back into the fold here anytime soon.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see him very often. I don't speak to him very often, but I tried to speak to him one of the games and tried to get out of him what was happening with him, but he was very quiet on that front. And I mean, we hope to have him there, because he's a great player and a great guy to have in the squad. But at the moment, I'm unsure of what his plans are, if he's ever going to be involved again, or if he's even in John Herdman's plans. So I don't know that current situation, but he's certainly a player that we would definitely welcome in the coming camps to come.
All right, to be determined still. I've asked everybody that I've spoken to player-wise this question, but what do you make of the job that John and his staff have done so far?
It's fantastic. Since the first time I obviously joined the camp, it was his first camp in Murcia in Spain in 2018. They really welcomed me in there, and it was certainly a camp that I really enjoyed straight away. His backroom staff as well, very welcoming and happy to have me. And it's just been great to be involved in, because the level of detail that they go into, and they're always working hard, and they want success, obviously, for the country. So it's something that I've really enjoyed so far. And we're obviously building and wanting to give this country an identity and something to be proud of. And that's what they're looking to do. And that's what we'll hopefully do in the future as well, as we've done so far.
And keeping on that subject, having earned your first cap 3 years ago, you've seen the evolution of this squad through various camps. And many have questioned past Canada sides, and even this one at times, about their mental fortitude in big games. Now, obviously, there are bigger ones to come, but having just played 4 games in, 10 days this month, in the middle of a pandemic, in 3 different cities, across 2 countries, at the end of a trying domestic season for most of you, what does that say about the mentality of this squad?
Yeah, it's brilliant. Like speaking to the sort of experienced ones that have experienced these sort of situations before, going to Haiti and getting a win there, they've spoke about it and said that These are the sort of games that you would maybe lose 1-0 in previous years, or just draw. But to go there and win is a massive thing for the country, and it shows the progress that we've made, and we want to keep that going. It's great experience going to these places and playing these games in such humidity and heat. It just bodes well for us in the future games to come.
And we got some listener questions on that same subject, just in terms of the morale within the squad and whatnot. Alex Trudeau wants to know, the players and staff on the national team seem to really love being around each other. Do you think the team chemistry is unique and special, and how did that bond become so strong?
It is. I mean, it's something that John and the staff have definitely put onus on us to create that environment for whoever comes into the national squad or whoever goes out of the national squad to be a part of. And everyone's a part of it, no matter if you're not involved or if you're playing. You always feel like it's like a family sort of situation where you're getting together like you've never been apart, sort of thing. It's just a great surroundings, great people, characters around the place. It's just something that you're always looking forward to be a part of.
And on the same sort of theme, Can MNT Opinions and Dan Clark asked, what makes this Canada group so different from years past? And what are your impressions of the team that has been assembled in general?
Yeah, I mean, it has developed over the years. From when I've come in, it certainly has. You see players coming and going, and even players that come into the camps for the first time, it feels like they've been there for ages. It's got that chemistry about it. Whenever you enter the camp, that just everyone's so friendly and they get on well together. And like, so this new camp, we had Scott Kennedy come in for his first time and played his first game, and he just slotted in like he'd always been there. It's just testament to the players and the staff in the camp that it's able to work so seamlessly all the time.
Well, obviously that morale and chemistry are going to come in handy during the octagonal. You'll have to manage triple match days in most of these windows starting in September. But how much did this June period prepare you guys for those quick turnarounds between games?
Yeah, it was really good. I mean, that's the thing when you're a player, you enjoy training, but you just want to play games, and to have games in such close proximity is good for us. And it just showed the strength and depth of our squad as well, that we were able to put out players and make changes, and it didn't change what we wanted to do and how we played. It just worked so well, and it just, as I said, it just shows the strength and depth of our squad that we've got, that we can do that.
Yeah, I think you guys made 11 changes from the Aruba to the Suriname game, which I can't remember the last time in my years covering the national team that they could ever do that and not drop in quality. It truly is astounding to think about. But maybe looking ahead to the Ocho itself, is there a specific team you're looking forward to testing yourself against?
I think no matter who we play, it'll be a test, because it is that stage where everyone's fighting for that. For the qualifying spots, and every test is going to be slightly different, but at the same time it's going to be difficult, and we want to test ourselves in each and every game. But we know that we've got the quality that we can hurt teams, and we can defend at the back as well. So we're just really looking forward to getting up and playing against the best teams. That's what we want to do.
Fair enough. Another listener question from Vince Alvarado. Do you plan to be at the Gold Cup? I know that your club commitments might overlap with this.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to give anything away, but I'll have pre-season and Europa League games coming up this year, obviously, with the success we had at the club. So it's a big thing for my club and a big thing for me personally. So it's something that I'm looking forward to. I would love to experience the Gold Cup, but it's just come the wrong time for myself personally. I know that no matter what, the squad's going to be strong as they're going into this. That's how it is. It's the way it works. Sometimes it just doesn't fall at the right time.
For sure. And we're going to get into some of those exploits that led you to this situation in a bit. Just a couple more questions on the national team side of things. Having played with them in a few windows now, what do you make of the growth of Alphonso Davies, Jonathan David, and the other young players as well?
Yeah, just they've just grown each and every camp. You can see the confidence building in them each and every time we get together, and the success, level of success this young talent are getting and with their clubs domestically is brilliant. I mean, winning trophies is what you want to do in your domestic club, and they've certainly done that this year, adding several trophies to each and every one of them, and it's just great to see that, and it builds them up confidence wise, and it shows that how talented these kids are, and I'm sure they'll bring their A game whenever they're called upon.
And maybe looking off the pitch, Freights at Crates of Freights wants to know, who on the team have you gotten closest with off the pitch?
Personally, it's Stephen Vittoria. He's sort of similar ages with me. He's got family back home as well. He's got two kids, and we share a love of golf, and we've certainly got close in each camp, and we've really enjoyed each other's company, being able to just sort of speak about different things and life itself. It's been great, and great to get to know him, and it just makes it easier when you know someone and get on well with someone.
Absolutely, it does. Mark Anthony Kay, after the Aruba game, mentioned how much he enjoys playing with someone like you, with your intelligence and leadership qualities. I'm kind of paraphrasing here, but that was the gist of what he had said. Mm-hmm. So we'll flip that question around to you and ask, what do you think about playing with him and the other midfielders in general as well, if you want to elaborate it?
Yeah, I mean, I find it a privilege to play with all these players. They're just such a talented bunch, and it's great to be a part of. But to hear his comments after the game and hear what you had to say was special, and it was very touching from my point of view to get that sort of recognition from someone that's at the top level, and it was just so nice to hear that, and I can reciprocate that to him, because I just know that he's always going to be controlling his side of the pitch. He's always demanding of everyone around him, and he's just got that sort of aura about him when he plays, the composure on the ball. He seems to find himself on the ball all the time, creating space for himself and being able, and you know he's got the talent to pick passes out. And I always know that whenever he's got the ball on his left foot, I can make those runs in behind that I'm pretty sure 9 times out of 10 he can try and find me. So I just know that I'm confident in his ability to be able to let him do his thing on his side and still be able to connect with him on my side as well. But you've got players like Stefan Ostakio who breaks up the play so well, but at the same time getting on the ball, he's so composed in his passing and his sort of ability to just run a game, which I felt like he did in Haiti. He seemed to control the game, pick up seconds, and just he was everywhere. But you've got so much strength and depth in that sort of area, where you've got Sammy Piette, who's, it feels like he's a veteran now, but he's still so young, who just fits in so well in that position. And Ozo as well is just his composure on the ball and his ability to set up goals and score goals and that end of the pitch, his intelligence is brilliant.
Yeah, truly a loaded group, if I do say so myself. Yeah. There have been quite a few Canadians to play in Scotland, David, but past and present. The ease of obtaining a work permit and speaking the language obviously helps, but what is it about Scottish football that appeals to Canadians, do you think?
I don't know. I think maybe the Scottish side of it is, some would see it as kind of a rougher game, sort of more physical sort of side of the game, because I know that like Liam Miller, who's down at Liverpool, he came up on loan to Kilmarnock, and he just felt like he was getting kicked about the park because it was more physical, and he certainly told me several times about that, but I don't know what it is, but it seems to have a connection and bodes well with the Canadians, so I'm just glad they enjoy it and look towards the Scottish game as well, because it's not the biggest of countries, and it's great to see its recognition.
For sure. Switching to your exploits with St. Johnston, this was a historic campaign. I don't have to tell you that, but for the listeners who maybe missed it, your St. Johnston team was the first club outside the Old Firm to win a domestic cup double since 1990, when Aberdeen accomplished the feat. Having played a pivotal role in both of those cup victories, how did it feel to both win the cup double with your boyhood club and to be a key figure in those triumphs?
Yeah, I mean, it's something dreams are made of, honestly. Folk have asked me so many times, but it still hasn't sunk in what we've achieved this season. Winning not just one cup, but to win two in the same year is just incredible for what we've done in such a small club in Scotland. To go and do that with clubs like in our league that have got players that are on, well, the clubs are on budgets way more than what we are, and reality really is, realistically, we were just punching above our weight, and we seem to we thrive on that, and we certainly did this year. The change of manager coming in, we started off not great, but our performances were great, but our results weren't there, and we just seemed to believe that we would kick on. We certainly did that, and we finished it off in style, winning trophies that the club's never won. Well, we won back in 2014, but before that, it was 100-odd years that we hadn't won any trophies. To go and do that this year, to win another two in the same year, is just an incredible and a massive achievement for the club itself. And to be a big part of it myself was just what I've been working hard for my whole life and my whole career. So I was very proud and very emotional. If no one saw my interview, I was very emotional after the game, and still am very emotional about the whole campaign.
Yeah, you can definitely tell. And as a result of that, you'll be playing in the Europa League, starting in the third qualifying round. What are your expectations for that?
Yeah, it's exciting. It's very exciting. It's going to be so tough, though, whoever we get, because it's such a massive stage of the tournament. But we know that we've got a team around us that we can believe that we can go out there and enjoy it. But hopefully we can do something. It's certainly, we didn't expect to win two cups last year, so anything's possible for us. And we know that, and we'll look towards that when the time comes.
Now, having said all of this, putting you on the spot here, David, but does this mean you've surpassed Nick Dasevich as the best Canadian international to represent the club?
Well, I would say maybe the more decorated out of the two, but he's certainly one that I'll always remember and always looked up to when I was a young kid watching the game and supporting St. Johnston. He was always one that I really enjoyed watching, and he certainly is still a St. Johnston legend and always will be. But I mean, that's not for me to decide who's the better Canadian out of the two.
Fair enough. Got another listener question here from David Anthony. He wants to know how your time at Hibs compares to your time at St. Johnston. So if you had any maybe fond memories of your time at Hibernian, were there any?
Yeah, I absolutely loved it at Hibs. I know that people that know me, I still have a soft spot for the club and always will do. It's where I've played my football for the first time as a professional, so it'll always be in my heart, and it's certainly in my family's as well, because my father-in-law and, well, my wife as well, they were Hibs supporters. Well, he still is, but well, I'm sure my wife supports St. Johnston now just because of me. But no, Hibs is still a big part of my family and always will be, but St. Johnston, where I grew up, and my family, my brother, my mum and dad, they all support St. Johnston growing up, so it's more closer to the heart and more of a family club, I feel, at St. Johnston, and thoroughly enjoyed my time, and I've just enjoyed playing football and being surrounded by great people as well.
Well, your contract doesn't expire for another couple of years, but we actually got quite a few questions or requests to ask you this, but would you be open to playing in North America at some point in the future?
Yeah, it's always been in the back of my mind when I joined Canada. I've always thought about it. Something that I would definitely consider if it ever came along. But at the moment, that's not my pathway. At the moment, I've just signed another 2 years at St. Johnstone, and thoroughly looking forward to the next campaign. Looking forward to that. But it's something that I would consider if it ever cropped up.
And Vince Alvarado, he wants to know, looking ahead as well, how long do you see yourself playing internationally? Like, do you hope to be around, say, going into the 2026 cycle when the World Cup comes to North America?
Yeah, I mean, I'm hoping to play as long as I can. As like I said before, it's not a long career, but I want to play at the top level as long as I can, and I'm thoroughly enjoying my time as a professional footballer right now, and I want to continue that as long as possible, as long as my body lets me as well. And obviously just going to take it sort of day by day and week by week, and not thinking too far into the future, but obviously that would be a real pleasure if I was to still be around at that point.
Well, to close it out, David, I'll start on, I don't know if it's a light note or not, it depends how you see it, but I assume you watched Scotland at the Euros. What did you make of their performances? I mean, I guess, you know, as a consolation, it must have been nice to get a result from England at least.
Yeah, it was great because obviously all my family were rooting on Scotland, and at that point, right at the start, I was away with Canada and enjoying my football, and they certainly were getting built up for this whole occasion because it's a massive thing for this country, and it's not too often they get into big tournaments. And I felt the first game, maybe the pressure of playing in front of a home crowd, and I feel like maybe if the tournament was in a different country, I think the sort of mindset and everything would be a slightly different going into a game, rather than playing it in front of your home crowd, where I felt like there was a bit of pressure for them to go out and perform and get a result, because everyone looked at it and thought, right, they had to go and win maybe the first game, because that was probably their easiest out of the three, they thought. But these teams are top class, and it was always going to be difficult for them. And they always thought England was going to be a tough one. But you could see when they went down to England, the sort of passion and the fight flowing through them certainly put on a performance to be proud of.
Obviously, it would have to fall this way, but what would it be like if you guys qualified for the World Cup, Scotland was there, and you faced Scotland on the biggest stage?
Oh, it would be super exciting. It would be very exciting for me. I would love to do it one day, just to go out there and play for Canada against Scotland, because it would just be an extra special moment and something I'd be very proud of. And I would really enjoy the moment, and I would love to go and beat them.
There you go, Canada fans. Well, David, listen, thank you so much for the time. It's greatly appreciated. Good luck to you this upcoming season, and then as well with future games with the national team.
Thank you very much.
The Northern Football Podcast is partnered with FTF Canada. If you are a soccer player aged 15 to 18 years old, or know someone who is, and have NCAA or U Sports aspirations, well then FTF Canada is the place to get you connected with the scouts who will help you achieve those goals. Use the promo code NFP2021 for 10% off FTF Canada's Boys and Girls Soccer Combines. For more info and schedules, go to ftfcanada.ca and follow them on Twitter at @FTFCanada_ and on Instagram at @FTFCanada_. All right, and moving over to some MLS talk. TFC 0, FC Cincinnati 2. TFC losing yet again, and the pressure mounts on Chris Armas. Thomas, I tweeted this over the weekend, but you know, when your experienced players aren't getting the job done, and the GM preaches about the younger players and wanting to give them opportunities. What's left to lose at this point by playing them, especially when the likes of Prizo and Akinola are doing well, be it off the bench or as starters?
Yeah, it's a fifth consecutive loss for Chris Summers and Toronto FC. And I've always said this in the past, and I'm going to say it again. If you attempt to do something again and it isn't creating the same results, the definition of insanity is doing something over and over and expecting different results when it wasn't working. And I just don't understand why he keeps going with more or less the same 11. I'm just counting on his experienced players, which aren't getting it done, as you just mentioned. You know, at this point, I understand it to a certain point. Obviously, you want your players, your more experienced players, to get you the wins, because obviously, especially a coach that is coming into a successful club that has been the last couple of years, he is subject to results, and he's going to count on guys that have been there and done that. But like you say, I mean, you know, it's not like there's a quota or anything on MLS minutes, but I mean, Akinola is an example. Prizo did it for a couple of games, and it doesn't make sense why he's benching these players. I mean, right now, Chris Harmes is sort of in a pickle. He's experiencing a lot of, you know, bad timing. You know, we saw what Quentin Westberg, you know, gave an interview to a French outlet. He said, quote, "I don't know what direction this club is going." And I think that just gives you an idea of how things are in the locker room. But I also want to say that, you know, it's also tough on the players. I mean, we saw Chris Mavinga tweet out that, hey, we're away from our families. We're in a hotel. We're not playing in front of our fans, and that's affecting us. Please support us. So there is sort of that human aspect as well. And look, I mean, last year, I mean, they started off great and then ended up in the playoffs. I had heard that, you know, the players just weren't there mentally.
Right.
And it's true, and it showed. But, you know, as we approach closer to August, I think TFC coming back in August will make a huge difference.
Well, and that's why I wonder if not just Toronto, but all the other Canadian teams should be given some slack, just because for a second season in a row, they're having to deal with this. And I'm not saying that's an excuse, because we're still seeing the same tactical issues. But I suppose if we're looking at the team's current form, and maybe just a quick prediction before we move on, Thomas, do you think Chris Armas gets fired here shortly, or does he get a run of games in Toronto before the club makes the decision?
Yeah, look, if he were to lose the next five games, like therefore a 10-game losing streak, I could see him get the boot. But I also have a feeling that he will finish off the season. The reason I say that is because of his relationship with the general manager, Alec Curtis, and a few of the players as well. I think that affection never goes away. And we just don't know how much money he's on. I mean, we also have to consider the financial factor as well. I mean, they have to buy him out. They're not going to fire him considering how much money has been invested. We'll have to see how many more years he has left in his contract. But my prediction is that he'll probably finish off the year. But like I said, if he were to lose the next 5 to 6 games, then there is a lot of reason to let him go.
Yeah, I agree. And this is really the precarious situation that Toronto FC finds itself in, as well as another team that we're going to talk about momentarily. Before we do, diving into Nashville 1, Montreal 1, a lot of really interesting storylines to take out of this game, because Nashville equalized late after Kiki Struna opened the scoring for Montreal. Alistair Johnston, by the way, going 77 minutes in the match for Nashville and looking decent again, as he often has this season. But the story of this game for me, Thomas, was James Pantemis, especially ahead of the Gold Cup, because as Patrice Bernier mentioned on the French broadcast, and our friend Tristan Damore brought this up on Twitter, Clement Diop's injury could keep Pantemis in Montreal and therefore rule him out of the Gold Cup. Not saying that that could happen, but it is a possibility. So if that ends up being the situation, what happens squad-wise if Pantemis can't go?
Yeah, I think you'd call up Jason Lutweiler. I think he'd take the third spot. Pantemis wasn't going to play anyways at the Gold Cup. He was going to be a third choice behind Crepeau and St. Clair, I would think. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for him to get a string of games for CF Montreal with Clement Diop injured is only a positive. I mean, they're not playing. Him and St. Clair are not playing. St. Clair obviously has a much tougher task, mm-hmm. considering how good Tyler Miller has been for Minnesota United. But, no, you want to see Pantemis play. He looked good in this game against Nashville. We saw a picture at the end, him taking a picture with Alistair Johnson. It's great mm-hmm. to see that. Looks like the Canadians and MLS are becoming more close. I don't know about you, Peter, but, you know, just seeing how, you know, Tesha Kandel is getting a lot of minutes, Tayshaun Buchanan getting a lot of minutes, this might just be the toughest decision that John Herman has ever had as far as picking a 23-man squad.
Oh, easily. And it's situations like this that make it all the more difficult. But look, if Pantemis does go to the Gold Cup, and I mean, really either way, I don't think you could begrudge Montreal for keeping him. If he were to be released for the Gold Cup, I think it would be a nice reward for what he has done so far, because even though he's only played a couple of games this season, that performance was incredible. Like, if it wasn't for him, Nashville could have easily won that game. And when you look at his underlying numbers now, I think he's on something like plus 1.2 post-shot expected goals plus minus, so he's saved one more goal or so than he's expected to save this season, though a lot of that was from the weekend's game. But regardless, you can see progress there. And if he has to step in for Diop, and that's what he's showing in his first appearance since the injury, then that can only be a good thing for Montreal. But yeah, I agree with you. If Pantemis can't go, the third spot could probably end up going to Ludweiler, just because he's played more recently than someone like a Thomas Hassall, even though he ended up being rooted to the bench at Huddersfield.
And there's no way they're going to take two keepers from the same club.
No, that's also true. That would be very...
Well, only in Honduras that happens.
Yeah.
Like, I remember the one time in the World Cup they brought the first and the backup of Olympia. Like, I just shook my head when I saw that.
Yeah.
But, we also have Kamal Miller, who is back from action. He was injured, missed the June window due to injury. Great to see. Samuel Piet had a solid performance again. He always does well when he's on the pitch. You know, gives you that something different than when he wasn't on the pitch. We didn't really know. He was asked about it in press conferences before. Wilfred Nancy, that is, asked why Piet wasn't. But obviously, when you have a designated player, you kind of have to give him minutes. And once again, Montreal didn't lose him with starting. Thoughts on either of them?
Well, yeah, the fact that Piet is on the pitch to start the match and then Montreal once again doesn't lose. I mean, they probably should have ended up winning because they let it slip through their fingers late. But that's now two wins, three draws, and a loss with Piet starting. And I think they only have one win from four games when he is on the bench or just isn't in the team at all. So that kind of goes to show you how integral he is. And the fact that he has now made strides when it comes to his progressive passing and just his vision overall, I think is a testament to the work Thierry Henry did when he was there and playing Piet in that advanced role, because now you see him a little bit more comfortable in those situations on the ball. And it showed. He completed 39 of his 47 passes. I think he had one key pass in the game, which is becoming the norm for him. He won four of his six defensive duels, three interceptions, two tackles. I mean, just an all-around amazing showing. And then for Miller as well, picking up where he left off from the injury, and that is quite comforting from a Canadian perspective. Five clearances, looked pretty good in the air, which has been a weak spot for him in games this season. Completed 83% of his passes, looking good in that area as well. So for both of them, just an overall solid showing, really. And same with Broguiar, even though he maybe wasn't as involved in the final third as he normally is, you can't say he really put a foot wrong in that match either. And moving on to Seattle 2, Vancouver 2. The Whitecaps end their losing streak, but remain winless and bottom of the Western Conference, despite the point. They actually led in this game at some point, which is incredible considering the run of form Seattle's in. But Thomas, Lucas Cavallini returned to the score sheet after an 8-game drought with the club, obviously was still firing them in for Canada. I know that his national team form doesn't suffer despite what he does with his club, but that has to be kind of encouraging for him to finally end that long run without scoring, no?
Well, absolutely. I mean, like you just said it there. I mean, his national team form is always great scoring-wise because, you know, he has been that consistent with Canada. But it's always a bonus when his club form is good too. I mean, we've seen players in the past and, you know, not to make any comparisons here, but especially in Europe and South America, where, you know, you have your players where they have great club careers, but when they put on the national team jersey, they just can't do it for whatever reason, mm-hmm. a couple of factors. And you have the guys who do good with the national team and, you know, vice versa, don't have as good of a, you know, club career, you know, do well, but aren't always at the higher level. But Lucas one, it's an interesting one because he has he's in a struggling team, so it's not just his problem. You know, it's not just, you know, it's Lucas Cavallini, so he's in a struggling team, so there's that. But if you were to have Lucas Cavallini in a top Major League Soccer side, I think he'd probably be banging in a goal every three games. I mean, that's how I feel about it. You know, he was that good in Mexico. And you know, Puebla, you know, aren't, you know, one of the best teams in Mexico, but, you know, that style of football allows him to, you know, play with liberty, with a lot of freedom, which I think, you know, Vancouver's been way more too structured. But it's definitely great to see. Well, the only thing that I would say is Cavallini has, you know, solidified himself with Canada, but because he's playing, you know, at the MLS level, he's always going to be that fourth striker as opposed to maybe a guy that will go right into our 11. But if he was banging in a goal per game, I think otherwise.
Well, you make a good point about his time in Mexico and how he can be, you know, a goal every three game type of striker, even a goal every other game, depending on, I guess, the players around him. The one thing Vancouver doesn't do that Canada does, which is why his form stays the same, is Canada utilizes the flanks. They get players into those deeper areas, down towards the byline, send in quality crosses for him, because he likes to get those early crosses, those low kind of in-swinging crosses into the box that he can run onto and finish. And then in the air, he's quite solid as well. You don't see that as much in Vancouver. And the fact that we saw that this past weekend from the Whitecaps, you know, the fullbacks getting forward helped every attacker, including him. It also enabled them to surprise the Sounders with those route run passes, which eventually led to Cavallini's goal, both goals, actually, same for Christian Dahomey as well. So that's why I think you're seeing that in terms of Cavallini getting the goals, or the goal in this case, with the Whitecaps, and why you see him score more often with the national team.
Yeah, certainly. And elsewhere, Michael Bellissimo and Christian Gutierrez were excellent. For Gutierrez, you know, back in the lineup, some people were, you know, concerned about whether he'd make it to the Gold Cup. But, I mean, slotting back into 11 just like that, you know, gives you that certainty that he is okay, that it was very minor. You know, apart from maybe Baldissimo's turnover for Seattle's first goal, we knew that Goody was, you know, likely going to be in the squad. Has Baldissimo solidified himself for a call-up, maybe in that as the last midfielder to be called up?
Well, as you know, Thomas, he was in my 23-man squad on the show last week. And if you haven't listened to that yet, listeners, go back an episode and you will hear our 23-man squads. Not our predictions, but just who we wanted to see. And Michael Baldissimo is someone I want to see with the national team. And I think he's just so good at orchestrating and progressing the ball. And if Stefano Stacchio is not there, all the more reason to call up someone like Baldissimo. The only issue with bringing him in is he does lack the defensive qualities that Ostacchio has, which is why maybe a Baldissimo, Piet, K trio would be fine, but Baldissimo's not all action like Ostacchio, so that's why you maybe need to have the protection of Piet next to him. But Thomas, I mean, we also saw on Seattle's first goal that Baldissimo's maybe lack of strength was a bit of an issue, because he was kind of fouled, whether it was rightly or wrongly, quite easily. And you saw his frailties in those situations. But on the ball, absolutely has to be there. I mean, 30 of 32 passes completed, 6 for 6 on the long ball, quite sublime.
Look, I think he's a good player. I really do. I really do like him. But, I mean, I just don't think the sample size is there yet. 541 minutes so far on the MLS, 703 minutes in 2020 with the Whitecaps. I'd like to see him, you know, do a full season, talking about 2,000, 2,500 minutes, you know, have a bigger look at him, more or less. Kind of like how Harry Payne had with Ross County in the Scottish Premiership. So that's the only reason why he wouldn't be in my 23-man roster. Would he be close? Absolutely. But, you know, that's just what I think. And he has shown good. I mean, he does deserve to continue to be getting these starts. And you can't say the same for a lot of MLS players. I mean, even though right now, I guess we're spoiled with all these Canadians playing in the MLS week in, week out. It's not like it's 20 of them, you know. It's, you know, you have maybe 8 or 9 that are starters, and then you have maybe 6 or 7 that are kind of rotational players. So we're still not, you know, the depth has improved, absolutely, but it's not like it's, you know, massive, you know, to the point where we have, you know, 40, 50 players to call up on, and, you know, 20, 25 of them are from the MLS. Although you have, you know, that situations where John Herman can call up a taxi squad if the MLS is on break. But Christian Gutierrez, we didn't really think that maybe we both have him in our 23-man squads for the Gold Cup. You know, good thing that he was healthy. And for people who don't know this, I actually tweeted this out. Christian Gutierrez is also cap-tied because he already filed his one-time switch in January of this year. So he doesn't need to be played, I guess. He's already ours.
Yeah.
But considering Rueda, who's now managing the Colombian national team, that actually spoke about him in August of last year, gives you the idea that, you know, Herdman is seeing something in him. And now with Atakubi now in Turkey, unless you're not playing Davies, do you expect Gutierrez to be the number one guy in the Gold Cup?
Yeah, I can see that for sure. Moving over to the CPL, the 2021 season kicked off at IG Field in Winnipeg over the weekend. Every match ended with a winner. Ottawa beat Edmonton, Pacific got one over HFX, Valor defeated Forge, and then Cavalry beat York United. The CPL's return was the subject of our poll question this week, and it was, how excited are you that the CPL is back? 161 votes were cast. 68.9% of you are very excited. 16.1% are somewhat, and 14.9% are indifferent. And listen, Thomas, I mean, I'm sure I can speak for you on this. I'm excited for the CPL's return, and it seems like a sizable portion of the listeners are as well. But please let us know if you want, you know, individual game recaps for the CPL, because for MLS, it's different. You know, there are individual shows that focus on the specific clubs, but the CPL is our league, and maybe going in depth is what you want from us, but maybe it isn't. And that's really up for the listeners to decide.
Yeah, definitely. You know, we have, you know, we cover so much, you know, with the Canadian national team being our priority, and obviously the women now in the Olympic and CPL being back, you know, Canadians abroad, which obviously the Canadians in Europe are, you know, on break because it's summer. But let us know what you think. Personally speaking, I'm super excited that CPL is back. As most of you know, this is where I got my start, you know, as a journalist. Finally, we have some games to talk about. I mean, we talk about over 300 days of no action being played. And these guys just go out there. Fans don't know what to expect. Clubs don't know what to expect of each other.
Yes.
Let alone, you know, themselves. And I think they put on a show. What I am super excited about, and I'm going to actually put out an article on Babbel.com. You can check out my Twitter at Thomas Neff. It's great to see that there's actual games being won, because last year in the Island Games, yes, it was only 7 games, but the amount of draws that were just happening, like it was just draw after draw after draw after draw. And now we have 4 games, 4 winners, you know, it kind of evens the playing field in a way. And, you know, looks better from an optics point of view. Let's talk about, you know, the rest of the games. And the shock of the match day was, you know, Valor, you know, home favorites, obviously being played in IG Field in Winnipeg, but, you know, with no fans and all. Them being Forge, who many, including us, maybe tipped them as the favorites for winning the title again this year. Did we underestimate Valor? You know, I know that Rob Gill is calling for respect for his players.
He is. And quite frankly, look, I somewhat agree with him in a way, because Austin Ricci is someone who I thought completely transformed that Valor attack last year. The way he holds up the ball, the way that he creates space. And I think he was unlucky not to score more often at the Island Games last year. Now Valor has someone like Kevin Aleman, who was given a free role on that right side and I think connects very nicely with him. The Dyer-Ohin duo was tremendous defensively as well. Valor was just on it from the start, and Forge was awful, truly lethargic, especially in transition. And then the odd cross they got into the box from a Schwanier or whoever it was, there was just no one getting onto the end of those crosses, because, you know, whether it was Babouli or somebody else, was just too deep. They maybe needed a Anthony Novak type forward, ironically, to latch onto those crosses. But from the Valor perspective, I actually rated them decently highly. The defense was maybe the one question mark just because of the changes that happened there, but a very good start. And for Forge, maybe it improves once Borges and Brown and the rest are brought in and settled. But I mean, that was rough for them, but terrific for Valor.
A little concerned going into the CONCACAF League, considering that Forge are CPL representatives in that competition. They're going to be hosting again for a second straight year, Club Deportivo FAS of El Salvador. Mm-hmm. And look, I mean, you know, if they're not dominating in the domestic tournaments, you know, I do hope that they do represent Canada well in that competition. I mean, it's huge for, I mean, we saw how Victor Montalbano said how he received tons of calls from different people in different CONCACAF countries, and it's going to matter. Your international image as a league matters. But I don't know about you, but I was, you know, shockingly surprised. We had FC Edmonton head coach Alan Koch on the previous episode, and, you know, he said that it's going to take time for his squad to gel, to get together. It's not going to come quick, you know, in the flip of a switch. And that's what we saw. You know, we saw Dylan Pauly, a former FC Edmonton goalkeeper, getting the shutout against his former club for Atletico Ottawa. And not just that game alone, but Balor's game with Jonathan Giroux, who was loaned from CF Montreal, first professional match, gets a shutout as well, a clean sheet. You know, good goalkeeping will win you these games, and, you know, it's certainly showing from the get-go. Well, what do you think about Calgary defeating a youthful York United?
This was wild to me because it was a very youthful York United team. 24.9 years was the average age of that 11, and it was only that old, quote-unquote, because the likes of Roger Thompson were starting. And in the end, I think we saw the experienced side be more clinical than the younger one, yet it was Thompson, one of the experienced players on York United, who committed the error for the second goal. Michael Petrasso gets beaten in the air for the first goal. But York United was all over them, particularly Diadine Abzi and Lowell Wright. They were both everywhere, especially Abzi. Like, he could have had a couple of goals, couple of assists, ultimately scored off the free kick, which was tremendous. But it's a disappointing result for York. I mean, kudos to Calgary for being clinical, but they didn't look all that sharp, to be honest. So they'll love the fact that they won that and start with 3 points. And maybe, you know, the fact that some injured players are coming back, Escalante is getting settled in. They're probably going to be a bit more optimistic that once it's up and running, that they'll end up hitting their form in the next couple of weeks. But for York, those kinks, like building from the back, will be ironed out over time. But, I mean, it is a rough one to take, but you had to like what you saw if you were a York United fan. If they work out those issues, they'll be more than fine.
Maybe let's go back to the Atletico Ottawa, you know, etching out FC Edmonton. This was the opening game, but it wasn't the surprise. The surprise being, obviously, Valor beating Forge. BT Martinez, you know, getting used to the North American game. He said he wanted to, you know, get more adjusted. It's interesting because in 2019, the amount of foreigners that came into the league, you could argue that weren't the best quality. You saw guys that were 32, 33, 34, and, you know, kind of not washed up, but, you know, they were, you know, in the sort of final stages of their careers, per se. And then you bring in this new agency who brings in more youthful players who have a bigger pedigree. And thanks to this Atletico Ottawa, I guess, scouting system, you see players, you know, coming from Spain, a different style. Did you see that in Vitor Martinez? Not only the goal itself, which obviously came off an FC Edmonton error, but as well as the Spaniards that are playing on this team.
Oh, I think so. I think you do see the quality, especially in a league like the CPL, where I think the pace of play is a little bit slower than they're probably used to. And I think that suits them very nicely. Yet, I feel like this game could have gone either way, despite the fact that Atletico, and Alan Koch mentioned this on our show last week, Thomas, they might have an advantage over other teams because they'd been doing their preseason in Spain and, as far as I recall, actually played games there. So they had an advantage over all the other teams in the league in that regard. Yet I thought Edmonton went toe-to-toe with them. I loved Asua in that attacking role on the right. I thought he was fantastic, created a lot of havoc. Tobias Worshevsky was excellent up front, and so was Ethan Ongaro deputizing, coming off the bench in the second half. But that Telfer, Shaw, Nunez front three, you can see it's going to be very, very exciting and going to cause teams a lot of problems. But certainly having those Spanish players in their side, I think will give them that extra little bit of quality that could get them into the, maybe not so much into the title race, but could certainly see them pushing for one of those playoff spots at the end of the year.
And finally, let's wrap it up with Pacific shutting out HFX Wanderers, the Battle of the Coast. 2-0 for Pacific. A bright start in the scoreline. What is more impressive to me, at least, is Ollie Bass's debut. A player that, you know, was kind of giving a lot of hype in the offseason when he was signed. Playing the lower leagues of England, second division of Australia. But talk about a foreigner who adapted in his first professional game.
Yes, absolutely. And Pacific in general got the job done early. And then I think at that point, kind of shut it off offensively by choice after the second goal from obviously Bassett and Bustos getting on the score sheet. And speaking of, I mean, Bustos for me was the MVP last year, Thomas, and he was terrific in the first half, pretty much unstoppable. And it could be a big year coming up for him. But on the opposite side, I mean, you could still say that HFX, despite the rocky start, could have maybe gotten themselves back into the game and maybe even a point in the end. Kari Jovanovic, who's new to the league as well, was torching that Pacific defense. And that's where the frailties lie for this Pacific side, especially on the wings and dealing with crosses. On the flip side, yes, HFX had their defensive issues, particularly with spacing between defenders. But things like that can correct themselves as the season goes on. Once players get minutes, they get used to each other again. And that's going to be the same, really, with every other team at this point.
And Marco Bustos, he said it before, he wants to leave the CPL. He wants to go to a higher level. And this is a huge season for him, you know, to, you know, push, maybe, you know, to go to a higher level, maybe like the MLS or an European or even maybe a South American top division, as he's kind of hinted at. Mm-hmm. For HFX Wanderers point of view, I mean, look, when you're the first place team and the second place team lose in the opening week, you know, it shows you that there is parity in this league. And by parity, I don't mean all those draws. Now that I mean, you know, actual, you know, clinical conviction wins, 3 points, whatever you want to call it. Let's talk about the Canadian Women's National, because they unveiled their 18-woman squad last week. And the full roster is as follows. In goal, Stephanie Labbe, Kaylin Sheridan. In defense, Kadisha Buchanan, Vanessa Giles, Shalina Sidorsky, Alyssa Chapman, Ashley Lawrence, Judith Revere. In the midfield, Jesse Fleming, Julia Grosso, Quinn, Desiree Scott. And the forwards, Janine Becky, Adriana Leon, Nichelle Prince, Deanne Rose, Kristen Sinclair, and Evelyn Vienz. The big shock, obviously, being Jordan Heidemas, omission. What do you think about it, Peter?
Yeah, this stirred up a lot of people, and they were kind of wondering, oh, well, Evelyn VN scores twice and, you know, doesn't really play a lot in the NWSL, yet she gets a spot over Heidema, who's at PSG and, you know, is more of a complete forward. But it's not like VN can't fill that same role. And when you look simply at form at the club level, Heidema has played around, I think, including the Champions League, 900 minutes this season, dating back to last summer. And she's typically a substitute for PSG. She's also not scoring a whole lot right now, whereas Vienne has done it in a national team shirt recently in some pretty marquee games, at least against marquee opponents. And just look at her Paris loan last year. Like, she was doing everything for a mid-table side in France. She was scoring, she was creating chances for herself, she was carrying the ball from deeper positions and threatening the goal. It's not like she can't fill that role either. And the fact that you look at form at this point in time, it does make a lot of sense to leave Heidema out and to bring VN in, especially if your aspirations are to medal. Now, if things go pear-shaped for Canada, I can guarantee you that's going to be looked at as a decision that Bev Priestman should have altered in terms of bringing Heidema to the Olympics. But right now, as it stands, I can understand why she made the decision.
Yeah, and, you know, you look at it from a, I guess, who's in better form right now, and it is Vienz. You can see that just the amount of forwards that they're bringing in, it's definitely going to be a heavy attacking side with only bringing four midfielders. Vet Priestman does make the exception because Jesse Fleming didn't play a whole lot in Chelsea. She gets called up regardless. And Heidema, isn't Heidema the future, though? I mean, you have her and she isn't in the squad. You know, she's supposed to be the next Kristen Sinclair, apparently. The other omissions that, you know, weren't as surprising, you could say. Erin McLeod, not a lot of playing time at Orlando Pride in the NWSL. Gabrielle Carl plays in the NCAA with Florida State. And a 32-year-old Sophie Schmidt, who has 204 caps. You know, I think someone like Desiree Scott in Kansas City and WSL can fill that veteran role with the other midfielders being in their mid or early 20s.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Thomas, now that we have seen the squad in full, have your expectations changed for the Canadian women at the Olympics? Like, do you still expect them to make a deep run, to medal again? Like, where do you stand?
I'm going to be honest with you. I think we're not going to medal this year. In 2012 and 2016, you could see flares of it. And leading up to the tournament, you could see that the results were coming in for Canada. But I just don't see it from this group. And not to say that there isn't the talent. The talent is there. The experience is there. A lot of these players have gone to the Olympics and have been at the World Cup. But if you look at the World Cup in 2019, it wasn't a very successful run. And it's not like the friendlies that Canada has played this year or last year have been amazing in terms of results. A lot of draws, some losses. And obviously against top 10 competition, you get to test yourself at the elite level. But when you're not beating that many top 10 sides, how are you going to finish third is the way I see it. I mean, especially not going in. A lot can happen in tournaments. Tournaments aren't the same thing as maybe qualifiers or lead up tournaments. But it does say something, and I just don't think we're gonna medal. I'd love to be proven wrong, though.
Yeah, I mean, my reservation is still with the attacking side of things. Like, even though the impetus is there to want to attack, you can just see it isn't clicking yet, and that is what will ultimately cost them if they don't medal. The defensive solidity is still there, so that can get them through one-off games in the knockout stage when they're trying to get to the medal rounds or to the medal games. But if they're chasing a game, I'm not going to be very confident in their chances, but we shall see. They certainly have the firepower. Closing out with quick little tidbit here. Thomas mentioned that there was a Canadian player linked abroad. It is Liam Miller. Some of you might already know this, but The Athletic in the UK are reporting that Miller is linked with Basel in Switzerland. Liverpool are looking to sell him for around £2 million. There's also interest from Odense of the Danish Superliga, Blackpool of the English Championship. Thomas's former youth coach, of course, is the manager there, as you mentioned. The New York Red Bulls are also sniffing around, and his previous club, Charlton Athletic, have also inquired to bring him in permanently after his loan from January onwards. Your thoughts on this, Thomas? Where would you like to see Miller end up? And maybe where do you think he'll end up?
Well, a couple of things. His Liverpool career is over. I mean, that's just just to throw that out there. Going back to Charlton, yeah, I don't think that's a good move. He played various minutes. And, you know, my co-host for the other podcast I do, Matthias Gress, who covers them, can say the same thing. He didn't really look all that comfortable at Charlton. And I think going back to League One for a second consecutive year wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. But, I wouldn't think that that'd be best for his development. Blackpool Championship, a lot has been said. You know, you get loaned to the wrong championship club, and that can really stall your development. Although there is some familiarity with his youth coach, I think he could get playing time as opposed to maybe another championship side where there's more competition. I've been saying this, you know, so many times, it probably sounds like a broken record. Denmark is a good league. I think Denmark's a good league that, you know, develops players. £2 million, wow. I said that off the record, but I think that's a little too much for Liam Miller. I think right now he's valued, for me at least, in the 500 to 750 range. I think $2 million is a bit too much. But I think when Liverpool does sell its players, I think you can up the price a lot, especially since he was a first-team player. He did debut in the FA Cup. It's not like he was just always being loaned out and in that U23 squad.
Yeah, well, he's also a full Canadian international too, Thomas. So like, it's not like the price tag is that, you know, out there, really.
I would say, I think going to Basel, it's a high risk, high reward situation. If you play, you're going to be playing some European football. And if you don't play, well, I mean, there's that. However, if he does get sold soon, which The Athletic is saying that will happen, I don't think we'll see Liam Miller at the Gold Cup because these guys are human beings. They have to, you know, get new bank accounts, get new houses. Settling with their teammates. They have to do so many things, you know, to move from a different city, different country. Mm-hmm. And not forget, I mean, he has a wife and he has a kid. There's that too.
Exactly. Which is why I think going to Blackpool to play for a coach that knows him and that he knows would be the most ideal move. But it does look like Basel is leading the race. So that probably is where he'll end up. And maybe playing on the continent could do him some good, right? Just getting out of familiar settings in England and testing himself abroad, playing in a different league. It could be really, really useful for him.
I think MLS would be a shame if he were to go that route. I know it's still unlikely to go to the New York Red Bulls, but I think he has to give Europe another chance, per se, before going back to North America.
I agree with that, for sure. That is going to do it for us this week. Thank you, everybody, for listening, as always. Please subscribe and rate us whenever you get the chance. It helps out the show immensely. So for Thomas Neff, I'm Peter Galindo. We will speak to you next week.